Stem Cell Exchanges. Your insight into stem cells from leading scientists.
An embryonic stem cell is essentially gives rise to every cell in the body. So every single one of us was an embryonic stem cell at some point.
I think we all are interested in embryos in the first place, because as soon as you can understand that you start off as a little thing and then you get bigger, then you start to wonder, well, where did you come from in the first place?
Welcome to Exchanges at the Stem Cell Institute with Mariana Alves in collaboration with Pint of Science. The Cambridge Stem Cell Institute is a world-leading center for stem cell research based at the University of Cambridge. Our mission is to transform the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of disease through a deep understanding of how stem cells work. We have 29 research groups with over 300 scientists spanning basic to translational research. You'll be hearing more from some of them in this podcast series. This week we are talking with Dr. Maria Alcolia, a new principal investigator of the Institute and affiliate to the oncology department.
I'll start by asking you, why did you get interested in the esophagus stem cells and esophagus cancer in particular?
Well, basically I come from a background of squamous epithelial tissues. We have had an increasing interest in trying to understand how epithelial stem cells actually regenerate those tissues and how disruption of the mechanisms controlling regeneration could actually be involved in the progression towards cancer. So the esophagus actually has two different strands why I became interested in it. One of them is because it is a very simple tissue compared to other squamous tissues, such as the skin. For example, in our skin, we are all very familiar with it. It has hair follicles, so it has the hairs that come out. It has different compartments, and therefore, it makes it sometimes a bit more complicated to understand what is happening. However, in the case of the esophagus, and particularly the mouse esophagus, which is the one that we use as a model, it is extremely simple. It's just basically layers of cells without no other additional compartments. And therefore, that makes it slightly simpler to understand how the cells change their behavior in response to, for example, wound healing or in response to tumorigenesis or other diseases.
And what have you discovered so far that made you start your own group and niche of research?
So it was very, when I started as a postdoc in Professor Phil Jones' lab, my project was from the beginning actually focused on the esophagus. They had been doing some studies in the skin, and we wanted to explore this esophagus for the reasons I was mentioning. And what we wanted to see is how these stem cells or progenitor cells, let's say, in this tissue were changing their behavior and were maintaining the tissue under normal conditions. So basically when we are just in a steady state in normal real life, what are the cells doing every day? And what we saw when looking at the mouse esophagus was that different to what was originally thought, that it's generally thought that the tissue is maintained in the long term by a population of stem cells that have a long life. We actually saw that the mouse esophagus was behaving slightly different and actually was maintained by a progenitor population that was contributing every day, because this subpopulation is thought to be quiescent, which means like they cycle very slowly and therefore they don't make a contribution in a daily basis. Basically, they produce a subpopulation that they divide faster, and then they eventually contribute to the maintenance of that tissue. But in the case of what our observations, what we saw is that actually most of the cells were cycling almost on twice a week, and then they were just contributing to the maintenance of the tissue. And therefore, it was slightly different to what it was thought to be happening under normal conditions. So we wanted to go a bit further and see if it's not working the way we all thought it was working, how it happens during regeneration. Is it still that all the cells seem to be contributing to this regeneration, or is it that actually a subpopulation, as it was originally thought, is the one that is contributing? And we saw that still all the cells seem to be contributing to the regeneration, all the progenitor cells, of course, not the differentiated ones so far. So that was the main observation we made. And then we went on to looking and see what happened when these cells started accumulating to genetic mutations that are involved in tumorigenesis. And then we saw how all the cells as well were switching basically their normal behavior towards the expansion of the tissue, let's say, and whether that could contribute to tumorigenesis. It's a bit complicated to explain it probably in just a couple of words, but basically we saw that these stem cells were able to expand and take over the entire tissue when they were acquiring certain mutations, and that the addition of additional mutations on top of those were the ones that were causing the development of cancer.
Studying how those mutations affect the stem cells, will it be possible to try to target that problem and try to treat?
At the moment in the esophagus, which is one of the things that also attracted me to the esophagus, was the fact that there are different type of tumors. Mm-hmm. There are different type of cancer. There is the squamous cell carcinomas, but there is also adenocarcinoma, and they behave relatively different. And actually, the percentage of people that are that have these diseases are different in different parts of the world. So it's not very well known yet what is causing the different type of esophageal cancer. What it is quite clear is that esophageal cancer is one leading cause of death. Cancer is the sixth most common cause of death of cancer for death for cancer, and that is actually something that has not been explored much. Why do we actually get these different phenotypes? There are some basic, for example, there is known that reflux generally leads to adenocarcinoma, and there is known that generally in Asia and for example in Japan, there is more tendency to have squamous cell carcinomas, and it's thought probably that there are like some environmental things that can affect. So those things also made me interested in knowing, so what is it that the cells, what are the changes that these cells made during these changes in during these different type of diseases. And that's what we are actually now trying to explore a bit more in detail, to see whether we can understand more the molecular mechanisms of how these cells change during regeneration, which in theory is thought that many mechanisms of regeneration are actually uncontrolled, or they lose their control during the process of tumorigenesis. We want to know whether what is happening, how these cells are changing during wound repair, and how those changes apply to the processes of tumorigenesis and different tumor types like adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma types. But we want to focus on the earliest stages of the tumorigenesis. Okay. Yes.
How are you doing that? How do you study these issues?
So the wound repair, basically, in John's lab, it was developed a technique that basically uses an endoscopy technique similar to the ones that we would get in the clinic. If, for example, we go to test whether we have a gastrointestinal disease, generally they do a biopsy to test the piece of tissue. So that's a similar technique. It's a refinement in the way people used to injure the esophagus in other institutions, and basically what we do is just take a tiny pinch of the esophagus, and instead of being interested in the piece of tissue, what we are interested is in the wound that is left behind and how the progenitor cells are actually repairing. So what we are doing is basically trying to explore the transcriptional profile of those cells and seeing whether we can identify mechanisms during the whole process of the repair, and more interestingly as well, whether there is some memory of these cells, because you know, like, this is something that has been ongoing in the field. Like, there is the cells that actually had undergone regeneration might actually never fully go back to a homeostatic state and have maybe more regenerative capacity and even more tumorigenic potential. So those are things we are trying to explore with this system. Regarding the case of the tumorigenesis, basically we have a model because we are interested in the very early stages of tumorigenesis. At this stage, we want to understand those stages because there is not much known in the literature. Most people actually focus their research in samples that come from full-blown cancer, and we want to know what happens actually before it is a cancer in itself. It's just like a lesion in the tissue. What are the molecular mechanisms actually driving the initiation of that process? And for that, we are using models that we, of mouse models, that we treat them with nitrosamines that are found in tobacco, for example. And then we can see how actually a small lesions start appearing. And if you combine them with genetically manipulated strains of mouse that have mutations for certain pathways involved in tumorigenesis, then you can kind of start seeing how they progress more or less. We have a particular interest in understanding the stroma, actually, whether during these early stages of tumorigenesis or cancer, if you want to call it that, whether the stroma is contributed significantly, not only at the later stages that are very well known to be contributed, but whether from the very beginning they are very relevant to the development of the disease.
And is this cancer usually found in early stages as a patient, or do you usually just diagnosed in the very late stages?
Yeah, that's the problem, that esophageal cancer is presented in the clinic very late. Generally, people, when they present, they have very low chances, mainly because it's, you know, like people do not realize until it's probably quite far along the lines of the disease. So what the idea is to try to go back to the early stages and try to understand a bit more what happens in the early stages and whether there was some way we could try to detect this disease, maybe whether it would be like a wide screen population or any other. I mean, there is quite a lot of effort in Cambridge already to try to do early cancer detection. So it'll be like within those efforts of the Cambridge community, can we actually find something that these cells are doing differently early, that we could detect them before the patient even realizes, whether just by, I don't know, family history or something like that, we could detect people, or maybe, you know, way of life, like, I don't know, alcohol or even tobacco or something like that, or reflux, and then they are like a high-risk population. Can we then try to find a marker to identify?
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, to identify them earlier, yeah.
How is it to be a new group leader, and how is the Stem Cell Institute for a new group leader?
I mean, the Stem Cell Institute has been wonderful. They have been always been extremely supportive, I must say, in all aspects. I mean, science at this level is always very competitive, so it's a bit daunting, like at the beginning, try to keep up with the actual, what you were doing as a postdoc kind of thing, like keeping up with the literature, and then having people under you that are, you know, taking care of different projects, and sometimes they diverge quite significantly, so trying to be on top of all the different aspects, it's quite daunting. And on top of that, you have all the administrative part, which is applying for grants, and then you also have to, initially, most of the time, you have to take care of, in my case, I do a lot of animal work, so take care of animal lines, and yeah, but it's very good fun. I am really enjoying it a lot. It's also very, you know, fulfilling, being able to do what you actually want to do with your research and try to progress it in the direction you are interested, and really look at the questions that you always had in your mind, let's say. So I think that, I mean, Cambridge is an amazing environment, and the Stem Cell Institute could not be better, I must say. Yeah, I'm very happy.
And what are the biggest challenges that slow down the research in esophagus stem cells and cancer?
Well, in my case, I use animal work, so sometimes it's a bit slow, you know, compared. Sometimes the problem is that our cells, epithelial cells and squamous epithelial cells, many times when you put them in vitro, they change quite significantly. There are models that you can still use. Now there are like three-dimensional models of tissue growth in a dish that you can still simulate, but eventually we always have to rely on what happens in the animal to fully understand what is happening. And animal work is slow in general. And our experiments, sometimes they actually last a year and a half, something like that, because, you know, there's the length of the experiments to try to get something meaningful out of what the cells are doing in the long term, out of how the tumor is actually progressing in the long term. And in many occasions, you actually find out after the year that you should have set up the experiment probably, you know, in a different situation. And we don't have, you know, the budget of, it's not like unlimited. Yes. So you cannot set up all potential conditions. And also for animal welfare, you would not do that. So first you want to see whether you can reach the information that you are interested and see. But that slows a lot in my sense, like, science, the or at least in my field, the use of animals makes it very, very difficult. And one thing, if I had to complain about something, would be the cost of, you know, animal work. That makes it as well like a really huge burden, because even though it's good because it limits the amount of experiments you do with animals, at the same time you sometimes have to, you know, like wait long periods of time until you actually get to know whether you have to do this or do that, and it complicates. But other than that, I think it's fine. I'm enjoying it. Yes.
And what are for you the biggest questions in the cancer stem cell field in general for the next 5 or 10 years?
I think now in the field there is a lot of excitement about in vivo live imaging. So whether, because most of the time we are using, for example, in some of these animal models, you actually have to kind of stop the experiment, you know, like finish the experiment and see what the cells are doing. And then you take samples at different time points and see how the cells are changing. But you are never looking at the same, very same cell. So now it's becoming like a very attractive field, in a subfield in our field, but basically trying to see whether we can see the cells in the animal while it's alive with non-invasive methods, basically. So many people are actually focusing in areas that are kind of exposed. For example, if you are studying the skin, then you can just have the animal and visualize the cells. And this would reduce significantly the use of animals, for example, in the long term, because you don't have to take many animals for looking at the long term, because you could do it with potentially a reduced number of them. And that is going to be very exciting to actually see whether our experiments that we have been seeing in end time experiments, which is the ones that we have been doing to date with the live experiments, they correlate, and we could progress in the knowledge of how tumors evolve much faster. For example, you know, there is a group in Yale, Valentina Greco, that is doing amazing work in this aspect, and she's observing things in real life and how tumors actually are developing from the progenitor cells. And of course that facilitates and makes the field to advance much, much faster. I mean, to me, one of the main questions that I'm particularly very interested in is to see what I was mentioning before, how the stroma and the epithelial cells communicate during the very early stages of tumor formation, for example. That's something that to me is very relevant, because we don't know much still how do they communicate, because so far most people have been focusing on the epithelium, let's say, which mutations arise in the epithelium, which are the mutations that we actually have to target in the epithelium with drugs to try to reduce the development of tumors. But actually now it's becoming more and more obvious that maybe doing combination therapies where you actually target probably the stroma, like now it's very it's becoming very fashionable, the immunotherapy, because it has very good prospects, whether combining, you know, like targeting the epithelium with the stroma, we could actually have a more meaningful impact in patients. And from the part of the regeneration, which is another aspect that I'm very interested, I want to particularly study plasticity. So basically now it's becoming, I was mentioning before, it's becoming more obvious as well that these stem cells have many different ways to repair the tissue, in the sense that it's not that they are just slow cycling and latent in the tissue and they just explode when there is a damage in the tissue. It seems that maybe actually it's more dynamic than we think, and cells that actually have started differentiation and they are not generally dividing much, they could go back and start dividing when there is damage in the tissue, mm-hmm. and effectively become stem cells when they were not stem cells. So that dynamic field is something that we don't know much about, and it's just like, you know, like just in the last couple of years, some papers have come out and started just to grasp that actually is there, because before we didn't even think that probably that was something very, very frequently happening. So yeah, those are interesting questions.
For people who are not familiar with the concepts, mm-hmm. Can you explain them what it consists of, the epithelium and the stroma mm-hmm. and in the tissue? Because some people have never seen them.
Yeah, basically, yeah, it's difficult to probably put these things sometimes in context without images. But basically, the epithelium, as I was mentioning, which is my main interest, the epithelium that most people know the best is the skin. So basically, you can assume that, you know, the esophagus has its own type of skin. So that's the epithelium. So it's what covers the tissues to actually protect them. Generally from, the skin, for example, protects us against any aggression that we are exposed to. It's our first barrier, actually. It's what separates us from the outside world, and it's our main protection, basically. And the esophagus is exposed to the exterior, even though it's inside of us. You know, like we eat through there, we are exposed to actually quite a lot of contaminants through our food, or that we actually want to ingest, like drugs or alcohol or tobacco. And that epithelium is exposed to all that and has to be resilient to survive and to actually maintain the integrity while exposed to all these things. So that would be the actual epithelium. The stroma is actually the cells that are lying underneath this epithelium. So basically it'll be the cells that give support somehow and give some structural support to the epithelium, because it has to sustain on top of something. It's like, let's say when we lie on a mattress, we would be the epithelium and the mattress is the stroma. Somehow, you know, like something like that.
That's a nice comparison.
Yes.
You talked about live imaging. Would that be easy to do in the esophagus, since it's kind of internal?
Yeah, it is internal. So in the esophagus is something that, most people, when we think about live imaging, probably it would be to use like three-dimensional cultures, because in reality it is very complicated. We have been exploring the possibility to do it, but still, like, the problem is getting the probes, you know, like the kind of device that you put through the esophagus that has the capacity to actually image individual cells and see that at proper resolution, mm-hmm. is not good enough yet to actually see this in real life. So I think at the moment the skin is probably one of the most exposed tissues, mm-hmm. to which we could explore a bit more. So from our point of view, doing like three-dimensional at the moment and comparing maybe with studies that have been done in the skin will be like an advance, because at the end of the day, they are squamous epithelium and they have significant differences, but some of the basic behavior is along the same lines. So hopefully we'll be able to learn as well from other squamous epithelia and then probably prove whether it's similar or different in the esophagus, probably.
And these progenitor stem cells of the esophagus, so they are programmed so in a way that if they have to differentiate, they will turn into an epithelial cell. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Yes.
So what do we know about how they get the cues to repopulate the tissue?
Yeah, basically the epithelial stems, progenitor cells, let's say, they have a close in, they are stratified in the sense, for example, of the skin or the esophagus, in the sense that what you have is the progenitors are at the base, so it's like they are the ones touching the stroma, and they are the ones receiving all the niche signals. So there is lots of factors that are actually released, and they are thought to be important just for tissue maintenance. It's not that we know a great deal about them yet. It's just like known that, for example, when you have an injury, the signals that are released from your stroma are actually essential for the epithelium to actually regenerate the tissue in the best way possible. And actually, it's also important, the signals from the stroma, for the cases where the wound repair actually does not go right, when there is like a problem in the healing of the wound. Sometimes signals from the stroma, if they are not the correct ones, what you end up having is a fibrotic scar. Basically, you don't have a proper repair, and what you end up having is just like a constant fibrotic accumulate, like fibers that accumulate there instead of a proper healing of the wound. So there are many signals, like there is like a huge number of signals, but we still like have not gone through knowing exactly how each signal crosstalks with the epithelium and at which particular stage is relevant. So there is like wide knowledge about many factors that are involved, like fibroblast growing factor, for example, or there is like TGF-beta, like there's lots of signaling factors mm-hmm. that are known to be very important for wound healing. But still we have a great deal to know, because before it was all done in a populational scale, and now with the new era of single cell transcriptional analysis, we could start to understand really whether there are subpopulations of stroma cells that are the ones that are talking to a particular subpopulation of epithelial cells, and how they actually talk throughout the process of regeneration, and whether we could more importantly manipulate those signals to be able to make the wounds regenerate properly in most cases.
So you also do lineage tracing mm-hmm. kind of study. So can you explain more or less how that works?
Yes. So lineage tracing is a technique we do to do everything that I have been mentioning. Basically, it's a technique where what we do is we use engineered mouse lines. So basically, mouse lines that have some genetic modifications that people have put in them. Most of them are just using fluorescent proteins. So basically what we have done is to put a fluorescent protein in an animal, but that is not very efficiently expressed. So we can control when, at what moment this animal starts expressing that protein, but they do not do it very efficiently. So only a part of the population actually becomes fluorescent. So what you end up having is, in your epithelium, of all the cells, so maybe you have like 1 or 0.5% of the cells are actually green, for example. And then you start with single cells in the tissue, and then over time these cells divide, produce two cells, and divide again, producing four, and so on, and they kind of expand. So looking back at the numbers of these little groups of cells, which we call them clones, because the group of cells come from one single cell, and they are therefore a clone. So these groups of cells, we then study how many are there that have differentiated, how many are there that are still within the progenitor compartment. And like that, we can actually infer what was the behavior of the original cell. And then you can combine that and say, so how this behavior changes in wound repair, how this changes during the process of tumor or cancer formation. And actually, you can extrapolate it as well to the stroma. You can actually label cells individually in the stroma and try to see whether there are some changes there and whether there's some kind of correlation between the behavior of stroma and epithelial cells, and try to see whether we can create a map of what is actually happening there in the different conditions.
That's very nice. You also mentioned 3D cultures, mm-hmm. so organoids, right?
Yeah, there are organoids or explant cultures. Actually, you can do different type of three. With a squamous epithelial, there are different type of three-dimensional cultures that you can do. For example, the organoid cultures are like, they form like a structure where you have the progenitor cells and the differentiating cells. But actually, depends on the type of studies you are doing, one or the other might be more relevant. For example, one that in our field we actually like a lot is the explant cultures, and it's mainly because it's the type of culture that has been used in the clinic for a very long time. When you have skin, people that get burns in their skin, for example, you can get a little piece of their skin and actually reconstitute it in three dimensions in vitro, and they're actually grafted back to the very same person to actually try to get like the closest to a regeneration after an important burning. So those cultures are very nice because they are very well known. They have been studying for a very long time in our field, and we can use them to try to understand. But of course, the problem sometimes we have with these cultures is we cannot forget that either of them, they are actually never homeostatic. They are actually all of them in wound mode. Mm-hmm. They are in repair. Either whether you
because
have
they were
them,
taken.
They were taken, and actually when you put them, these cells are very sensitive to space constraints. So you put them in a place that they don't have a space constraint, they just can't expand, and therefore what happens is that, you know, they just keep regenerating.
Mm-hmm.
There is now nice data showing that actually in the center of, because these cells kind of expand, but in the center they start having space constraints, let's say, because they are next to each other, and those start behaving actually like homeostatic cells. So there is now potential prospect to actually use cultures in a dish that actually behaving like closer to what we think is in homeostatic, and see how those change in response to wound healing or tumorigenesis or any other processes that we are interested in exploring. But you know, it's taken a long while to realize how this actually works. Yeah. So you have to be careful when you use these three-dimensional models to know what you actually are looking at, because they are really highly regenerative, of course.
And would it be possible to do those kinds of grafts to the esophagus, or that wouldn't solve the problem? Could you take like the tumor from the esophagus and then use the own patient cells to graft the wound, like in the skin?
Yeah, basically, if you do like a resection of an esophageal tumor, in reality, that is not the main problem, because generally you can just kind of, I'm not a medical doctor, but basically they just the esophagus will be fine. Sometimes it can have problems because you have removed a big part, and therefore if fibrosis starts appearing, that causes a lot of problems. But still, you can put them back together, and that's generally not the problem. The problem is that generally the cancer reoccurs and it has metastasized. So I think that's why we want to go way back to the initial stages
early,
to see whether we can understand something to probably not get to that stage. Like, is there any way? The problem is that patients do not notice until that point. But there is any way to stratify patients and maybe use some early markers to actually not get to the stage where, you know, even if we remove it. I mean, probably if we got it at the right point, when it's not still too late, a resection might be enough, yeah.
That would be very promising. It's very exciting.
Yes.
Is there anything you want to give as a message to the public about research in general or about esophagus stem cells?
I think, I don't know, one message very important is like sometimes it's better to, you know, to be cautious and prevent cancer rather than curing. Hopefully, actually, most experts actually say that probably that would, if we behave properly and we didn't overexpose our bodies to certain things, even though we have, of course, like our genetic predisposition that we cannot control. But if we actually were behaving a bit better, let's say like not consuming alcohol, or, you know, like actually the diet is very important, because sometimes this reflux could, in some cases, it can be related to the diet of patients. You know, you start abusing and do not have controlled diets, or if you smoke and, you know, like all these general welfare, you know, like suggestions that most doctors give us, probably we would avoid the development of many instances of cancer. So I think that's a very strong message we should be sending. We'll do all our best to try to, you know, like get to the bottom of how to identify them earlier, but at the same time, it's like a very complex issue. Like, cancer is like a very complex disease and it's difficult to understand sometimes. So I don't know, regarding general stem cell science, I think is very, very good prospects. I mean, it has very many limitations because sometimes we have to be realistic. And when we hear the news that, oh, this has been discovered and it's going to change our life, clearly things from the moment that are realized in basic science, they take very long time until they are going to represent a change in our lives. So sometimes we don't have to be... It's sometimes bad from the press that actually they overreact and try to sell it as if we have discovered, like... the cure for cancer, mm-hmm. when it's not the case, because that puts the public in a very uncomfortable situation of actually not trusting what we are doing, while it's just a miscommunication sometimes. What we try to understand, it takes time and many other researchers and many other groups of research to probably get to a point that is something that can be applied to patients. And there are so many instances of, you know, successful examples. But at the same time, if we really are not aware of what are the realistic options of each scientific program, then we can get to the misleading conclusion that we are all just doing nothing because it's all promises and then nothing happens. It's just that, you know, like, we have to be realistic in realizing what is real and what is just going to take 15 years to become a reality. Yes, so I think that's an important message.
That's a good note. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to this week's Stem Cell Exchange. To hear all our future episodes, subscribe to our podcasts. We will also be having an event in Cambridge in June where we showcase artworks inspired by the research of all the scientists we interview. For more information, go to stemcells.cam.ac.uk. We would like to thank our collaborators, Pints of Science, and the Stem Cell Institute Public Engagement Seed Fund and its funders, the Medical Research Council and Wellcome Trusts, for supporting this podcast. Have a great day.